Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or if you're feeling frisky and you don't mind typing an additional four characters, you can go straight to the good stuff at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we dare to tell the hidden truth about what's really happening in the world, the truth that the politicians and the mainstream media probably don't know about and probably wouldn't want you to know, even if they did know about it. And that truth is very simply stated, that the world is getting better all the time. And more importantly, not only is the world getting better all the time, but due to a convergence of accelerating change, emerging technologies, and emerging possibilities, we stand on the brink, if we play our cards right, of a dazzlingly bright future, a future that few of us have expected or would dare even to hope or dream of. And I can assure you of this, friends, that future, you may not have heard of it. Yeah, you probably wouldn't hear of it anywhere other than on Fast Forward Radio or a few like-minded sites, but it's one you're going to want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always, is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm super fantastic. How are you doing, Stephen?
Well, I can tell. You've never put it more succinctly or better than you just did in your introduction there, Phil. That's why we do what we do, and we enjoy it so much. So,
I've been working on the patter. I think we got to get that down. And in fact, there's a reason why I spent a little more time on it this week than last, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But before we do, I just want to check with you. How's your week been? Any updates for us on the exercise program? I know we had meant to check back in with you on your plan to go a week without eating mammals. How did that work out for you?
Well, I think the short answer is that I tried to amend my carnivorous habit and made it nearly 7 days. I made it about 5 days before I had to get back to eating mammals, I guess is the proper way to say that.
So you were off the quadrupeds for, what did you say, 5 days?
Yeah, about 5 days. I managed to, for the benefit of our audience, I'm on a low carb diet, which is very difficult without meat. I mean, to the point of impossibility, especially if you're exercising, which I'm also doing. And at Phil's recommendation and suggestion, and for ethical reasons, I lay off the mammals. They're the higher order animals, right? And I tried to do it for about 5 days. Chicken and fish started getting pretty old after that.
So that wasn't working for you. So you finally had to go back. Now, did you find that it impacted the workout program, or were you able to keep going? Okay.
Man, I was exhausted for much of the week. It seemed like I just wasn't getting enough nutrition from that. Maybe I just needed to eat more chicken or something.
Eat more chicken. That's what the cows always say.
That's right. The cows at Chick-fil-A. Yeah.
Chick-fil-A billboards, right? Yeah.
That's right.
Well, anyway, those mammals you didn't eat those 5 days are grateful for your
I guess, yeah.
We did report this week that PETA's put out a push prize for growing bat meat. So the day's coming soon when we'll all be able to eat meat and
feel good about doing it. Yeah.
Exactly right. We've also got with us Michael Darling. Michael, how are you?
I'm on top of the world. How about? I don't know if that's super fantastic, but I'm doing well.
Oh, that's great.
That's a step in the right direction. Do anything interesting this weekend? Loaded question.
I coach a baseball team of young children, most of whom have never played baseball before this year, and we won our first game today. So it was very exciting for a little cluster of 8-year-old kids.
Congratulations.
That's something, even at 8 years of age, you never forget, your first win in a baseball game. I know I remember mine at that age.
glad to finally report on some good sports news here.
That's right.
We've had such bad news, but actually, maybe I'll load the question even better. Do anything interesting Friday evening?
Friday evening, I picked you up at your office, and we went to the Boulder, Colorado Future Salon, and then I took you back to your office and came home.
Okay, well, I see the Future Salon made quite an impression on you.
We talked about things that might or might not happen in the future. I will say that.
Indeed, we did. We talked about what the speaker referred to as the Astrozoic era, the coming era of humanity living in space. I thought it was a very interesting discussion.
Astrozoic, I love that. That's cool.
Yeah, I've never heard that term.
The most telling moment for me in the evening, we were there, I don't know, I kind of wasn't tracking the time, but a little over 2 hours, I'd guess. At one point, he referenced the recent headlines about the United States having shot down that satellite, that one spacecraft that was supposedly a problem. And here comes the telling moment. I said, I don't believe that it really happened. You can't prove to me it did, and I can't prove it didn't. And no one really pushed back on that. And I was like,
sitting next to you, I believe.
Well, he didn't really push back. He just, it was like, oh, yeah, we really can't convince you.
That would have been interesting, I think, if people had tried to prove that that it had happened. But one thing that says is that group is definitely open to a wide variety of perspectives. However, as I mentioned to you on the drive back from there, anybody else hear beeps on the line?
I did, yeah.
I heard it.
Somebody was trying to make a call.
Okay.
On one of these lines.
On somebody's line. What I was going to say was, great discussion, a great group, very serious thinkers, very interesting ideas. But would you agree with this, Michael, that maybe a bleaker outlook about the future than we tend to take here?
Certainly a bleaker outlook of the present. I mean, it's just
right. It's
misery and horror everywhere you look, except that maybe in the future we can get into space and then it'll all be okay.
Yeah, there was some of that, and also just I felt a lot of, well, things are going to get worse before they get any better, that we've got to kind of pay our dues before we...
I sense that too, although I will say that the speaker, the guy who did the presentation on the Astrozoic era, did acknowledge that pioneers generally are pretty uncomfortable and sacrificing a lot. They go without whatever it was they had where they pioneered from in order to be the pioneers wherever they're pioneering to or at, and I think he got that part spot on.
Oh, I think that part is probably... there's probably a good deal of truth to that, but I think just the notion that we've got a lot of misery in the world and we're going to have a lot more before things get better was an idea that kind of stuck with me to the extent that I thought, well, you know, tonight on the program, I really want to articulate where we stand on those issues. So that, Stephen, wrapping it back to my intro this evening is why I spent a little more time on what we're all about here on Fast Forward Radio.
It's a good idea anytime, though.
Yeah, so that's my shout out to the Boulder Future Salon. Thanks for reminding me what I think about where the future is going. Okay, Michael, so we're gonna send you off into the chat room. You keep an eye out for interesting comments and let us know.
Will do.
All right. Well, at this point, I'm gonna waste no more time. We are going to bring out our guest, author Jim Elvidge, holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He has applied his training in the high tech world as a leader in technology and enterprise management, including many years in executive roles for various companies and entrepreneurial ventures. He also holds 4 patents in digital signal processing. Beyond the high-tech realm, however, Elvidge has years of experience as a musician and a writer and a truth seeker, and he merged his technology skills with his love of music and developed one of the first PC-based digital music samplers. And he also co-founded Radio Amp, which was the first private label online streaming radio company. For many years, Elvidge has kept pace with the latest research, theories, and discoveries in the varied fields of subatomic physics, cosmology, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and metaphysics anomalies. This unique knowledge base has provided the foundation for his first full-length book, The Universe Solved, which I had the privilege and pleasure of reading this week, which presents astounding evidence. he will tell us, that our reality may be under programmed control. So, Jim Elvidge, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you very much, Phil. It's great to be on the show.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And why don't we start off just by taking a step back, and let's talk about the origins of the Universe Solved. What got you interested in these ideas to begin with?
Well, as you mentioned before, a lot of these ideas have kind of been bouncing around my head for years. I've read a lot of books on various things. I tend to read more nonfiction than fiction. I tend to read a lot of science and geeky things. Not too long ago, I remember picking up a book called The Holographic Universe. I don't know if any of you guys have read that one by Michael Talbot. And that was actually the first book that I read that kind of opened my mind to the possibility of, you know, a real explanation for some sort of anomalous occurrences, things like, you know, telepathy or you know, why people might see things that other people might not. And you know, thinking through that, I've tried to keep an open mind about different physical and metaphysical anomalies, and you know, continued my sort of layman's research over the years. And I started writing a book, I guess it was about 2005. It was the 100-year anniversary of Einstein's special relativity. And like everybody else that year, everybody was kind of taking pot shots at poor Albert. And, you know, I started writing a book about relativity and what limits there might be and things like that. But in doing the research, I came across a thought, and I can't claim it's an original thought. It certainly was something I hadn't read before, but the idea was that the way quantum physicists describe our reality is very, very similar to the way a computer program works and the way computers model objects in a virtual reality program. And just making that sort of analogy, I thought was very striking. I started thinking, gee, you know, I've seen the movie The Matrix. I've read some of these, you know, some of these science fiction books and, you know, speculated about, you know, are we living in a simulation? And I started thinking, is it really possible? And pretty soon I came up with a bunch of categories of evidence that supported the idea. And so I decided to write a book on that instead. And that was the genesis of the Universe Solved.
Oh, okay. Putting together your ideas, or maybe in researching the book, have you come across a book called The Intelligent Universe by David Foster?
No, I haven't. But I'll write that
one. The reason I ask, my wife and I were shopping for furniture this morning. We were out looking for a coffee table, and we were at a Lazy Boy outlet. And you know how at furniture stores they leave books lying around sometimes to make this verisimilitude that you're like in somebody's living room or something like that. You know, they just buy these old books in bulk. And I just happened to be strolling past this coffee table, and it has this book on it, and it's called The Intelligent Universe. And I'm like, well, that's an interesting title considering what I've been thinking about all week. And I pick it up, The Intelligent Universe by David Foster, written in 1975, a book about the idea that the universe functions much like a software program. And, you know, I came back home later, and I was just thinking about this. I Googled it, and this book is very obscure, hard to get even on Amazon or something like that. There's not a lot of reviews of it. I don't think it went much of anywhere. But I couldn't help but think about what you wrote about coincidences and synchronicity. I mean, what are the chances that I happen upon a book from 33 years ago that happens to be on the same topic while I'm out looking for furniture.
That in and of itself could be evidence of a programmed reality.
Our confirmation bias.
Did I stumble upon an Easter egg at the Lazy Boy store, I guess.
Yeah, somebody's letting you know that we're onto something.
Interesting. So with that in mind, could you just briefly outline your hypothesis for us? Make your case in, you know, a couple hundred words or less that we're living in a computer simulation.
Okay, so there are a couple kinds of simulation that we could be living in. The sort of standard, you've got implants in your brain and you're being, you know, shown a different version of reality. That kind of simulation is one of them. And, you know, the state of technology in terms of brain implants and sensory stimulation and so forth is kind of at its infancy right now. But there have been a lot of experiments. MIT teams, Caltech teams have done some experiments where they can put electrodes in someone's brain, read the signals generated by sensory stimuli that they apply to monkeys and even humans. So they show them a picture, and they can determine within 80% what picture they've shown to them just by reading what comes out. So that's, you know, that's evidence that a computer could determine what your sensory stimuli is. In the other direction, camera signals have been fed into the visual cortex for blind people to allow them to see kind of rudimentary light grids. And the technology there is also growing kind of at Moore's Law rate. The light grids have increased by a factor of 4, I think, over the last couple of years in terms of the number of pixels. So it's possible to generate a simulation or, you know, the beginnings of one into somebody's brain. A lot of neurobiologists say that it will ultimately be possible to write information into the brain, to actually write memories into the brain, even though it's considered that memories are distributed throughout the brain. They are able to find out where particular memories reside and therefore eradicate them or write new ones in. So although a lot of these ideas are sort of at their infancy now, you know, if you take Moore's Law into account, it's just a matter of being perfected at some point. So the possibility of generating a simulation, you know, in somebody's mind is definitely real. But I mentioned that's only one possibility. Another one could be the physical manifestation of reality itself. So, in other words, it could be that what we're seeing, everything that we interact with, the stuff that we interact with, is manifested under program control in some way. And that sounds a little bit more outlandish, but when you think about the state of the art in nanotech, you realize that that's not that far off either. So, for example, nanotech pioneer J. Storrs Hall had a concept of a utility fog, which is the idea that you have millions or billions of invisible nanobots flying around. They can be completely transparent to you. You can walk through them. They can sense your presence. But under program control, because they could all be networked together, they could generate any kind of wavelength of light for different colors, and they could link their arms, or they could, you know, push against you. So, for example, you may think you're in a particular room, and then all of a sudden a brick wall appears, or a sofa appears, or you're at the push of a button, your room could turn from a dining room into a bedroom. These concepts, some people, Ray Kurzweil and others, think that they're not far off. They're maybe only 30 years off. So, again, it's a matter of scale. If you can create a room under program control, you could create an entire reality under program control, ultimately. So these are sort of the feasibility arguments to it. Once you've accepted that it's feasible, then you kind of look for what evidence there might be.
Before you go to the evidence, let me just say, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jim Elvidge about his book, The Universe Solved. If you have a question for Jim, would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 347-215-8972. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. So the book presents four or five different categories of evidence. And one of the first ones is one that's been around for probably almost 10 years now. Nick Bostrom, a philosopher from Oxford, wrote a paper called The Simulation Argument. And there are some people who claim that, you know, there was some prior work to his that was very similar to that. I don't know, but I know that that was the thing that I first read, and I was struck by it. And basically it says that there's three options for the future. At some point, we will be able to create these simulations that we're talking about, where you can, you know, create a computer-generated reality, either via, you know, virtual reality goggles, or via implants, or nanobots, you know, in your brain. So if that can be done, then he says one of three things can happen, and he defines the word post-humanism as the point that you reach when you can perform these simulations. So either we consciously decide not to pursue this avenue of technology, and I think we can kind of throw that out, because when have we ever consciously decided not to pursue something that was possible. The second possibility is that we will never get to that point because we'll destroy ourselves in the process. That's sort of the pessimistic view. And then the third view is we are probably already in a sim because at that point we'll run millions of them, and the odds that we're in the single non-simulation is, you know, very, very small compared to being in one of the millions that we will eventually run. So, you know, by definition, by his sort of logical argument, the optimistic point of view is that we're living in a simulation. The pessimistic point of view is that we destroy ourselves in the next 20 or 30 years. So that's just sort of a logical category of evidence. The one that I really like is the quantum mechanical evidence. Quantum mechanics says that when you get down to a very small granularity, 10 to the minus 36 meters, that space is actually quantized. And what this means is you look around the room, everything looks continuous. You can always find a point in between two other points that you're looking at. And that's the case when you look through a microscope or an electron microscope. Even, you know, the smallest things we can see, we can actually image atoms now. But there's no evidence that there's anything discrete about those. However, that's 20 orders of magnitude larger. An atom is 20 orders of magnitude larger than the limitation of quantum mechanics, or the so-called Planck length. And so what the physicists are telling us is that when you get down to that level, space itself doesn't exist in between two points. Space is defined by the points, and there's one point, and then there's a point, you know, a Planck length away from there, and there's nothing in between. And that's certainly, you know, kind of a striking concept, but what else works that way? Well, you know, a computer program works that way. Your monitor is based on pixels. There's nothing in between the pixels. And in a virtual reality program, take a gaming program or something where a tree is modeled, the model of that tree is going to have a limitation to its resolution. It has to. If it had infinite resolution, it would take infinite memory to store, infinite disk to store, and it would be infinitely expensive. So it has to have finite resolution. And time works the same way. Again, according to physicists, when you get down to 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, time isn't continuous. It kind of chunks along like ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk every 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, which they call a jiffy. So, again, a computer works the same way. It nothing happens in between two clock cycles of a computer. From one cycle to the next, logic units get filled with bits, stuff gets written out to memory, to disk, to peripheral devices, or whatever. But in between the two clock cycles, absolutely nothing happens. So the analogy is really almost perfect. And that, you know, so you ask the question, if our reality really works that way, what's the reason behind it? And I can't think of one other than it's under program control. So then, go ahead.
Let me ask a question about that, though. Does there have to be a reason? What if the universe just works that way, right? I mean, isn't that always kind of the ultimate answer to these physics questions anyway? If, you know, why was there a Big Bang? Well, that's how it works, right?
Sure, and I think that's the difference between philosophy and science. Science will describe how it works, and philosophy is looking for the answer to why it works. And this, you know, my book is a little bit more philosophical, I guess, than scientific, in that there isn't any scientific proof of this idea, and I think, you know, a great next step might be to come up with experiments that could lend more support to either the programmed reality or a non-programmed reality one way or the other, and help, you know, kind of narrow it down. But this is more of a philosophical thing. You know, one might make a statement that, you know, the universe could be continuous. There's no reason for it not to be continuous, and it seems just sort of gut feel that it might make more sense for it to be continuous. Why quantized? Why quantized at that level? Why not 10 to the minus 72nd or 10 to the minus 16th? You know, it's still way below our limits of perception. So why at that level? You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Let's come back to the philosophy in a minute. Let's look at the science, because Stephen and I were talking before. Before the program, one of the things I enjoyed most about the book is the summary that you give on history and current thinking in physics and cosmology. I have to compliment you. I think the best short description of string theory I've read anywhere is
in your book.
Really enjoyed that. And you go into M theory, brain theory, you talk about the Big Bang, the inflationary Big Bang, the many worlds hypothesis, the inflationary fractal multiverse, and then you talked about Julian Barber's kind of timeless configuration space that that he presents. So I guess the question is, why isn't one of those or some combination of those sufficient to explain the universe? Why do we need something else on top of that?
Because I guess there's nothing, there are still a few things that we haven't talked about that none of those ideas or those theories explains very well. Julian Barber's, I think, comes pretty close to explaining what we've just talked about in terms of the quantized nature of the universe. But what's behind it, you know, it's sufficient for scientists to say, you know, here's how it works, and this, you know, this is, you know, this is the resolution of it and things like that. But I guess what kind of drives me is what's behind it. And if you think that there might be something behind it, all of a sudden some of these other anomalies and, you know, the curious nature of the finely tuned universe starts making a little bit more sense. It does kind of tread into the, you know, religious intelligent design area, which scares a lot of people, but, you know, I just basically followed it where it led.
You know, one thing I would expect if we are living in a simulation is that we'd find evidence that the universe increases its resolution upon observation. You know, in a video game, if I'm walking through a 3D video game and there's a tree or something, it might have, you know, it has a resolution of a certain level until you zoom in on it, and then the computer goes to work giving us a resolution that's higher. In your studies, have you come across evidence of that?
No, I haven't, but it's something I've thought a lot about. I mean, is it possible that before we had microscopes, the resolution of reality was much coarser than it was after we had microscopes? You know, you could sort of imagine that. The way the dynamic resolution works that you just described, as you get closer and closer to a tree or to an object, the pixelation goes away because they'll pull in a different model that will model a cell or model something smaller. Imagine that in a game, say a massively multiplayer online role playing game, that people were not given the ability to get too close to something, and then somebody figured out how to do it, or maybe the programmers allowed them to get closer because they put a patch into the game, that gave the dynamic resolution that allowed them to look closer into things. So you could imagine a scenario where the game may have gone on for some period of time at a coarse resolution, but because the programmers decided it was the users were getting bored, or they were starting to ask a lot of questions, or they were starting to invent, you know, find ways to build microscopes out of the crude devices that they had at their disposal in that game, that, you know what, we better put a patch to this game and increase the resolution of it. And given, you know, a sufficiently sophisticated technology, that isn't really that hard to do.
That's interesting. Thanks.
Does that relate to the idea, and tell me if I read this wrong in the book, because I was talking with someone about this at dinner last night, and I may have overstated the case, but is it possible that before the 20th century our universe functioned under Newtonian physics, and quantum physics only kicked in when we started looking at that level?
Well, that certainly could be possible.
Is that an implication of that? Is that the equivalent of looking at a tree and it getting a higher resolution as you get closer in a game?
Yeah, I think it is. And another aspect of quantum mechanics is the whole observer effect. Traditional Copenhagen, what they call Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, says that you know, you heard of the Schrodinger's cat experiment, that something doesn't happen until it's actually observed. That's a similar effect in a computer program as well. If you imagine a room that's designed that nobody's ever been in, again, I'm talking about in a program or in a game, and somebody figures out how to finally open the door, it's only when they open the door that the inside of that room has to get rendered. Nobody needs it up until that point. So all of the experimental evidence for the observer effect may actually be very good evidence for the programmed reality effect.
That's interesting. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jim Elvidge about The Universe Solved. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972. Now, I need to give a disclaimer before the next question, because something I meant to mention earlier is that we often talk about paranormal phenomena on Fast Forward Radio, but we do it in a very lighthearted and humorous and skeptical kind of a vein. We're normally pretty skeptical of anything that lies outside of mainstream science. Okay, so we're gonna have to be for the time being Scully to your Mulder here. Okay, now. In the book, you talk about UFOs and Bigfoot and past lives and psychic phenomena. You devote a good deal of time and energy to those subjects, and you ask your readers to at least keep an open mind about them. But it's never entirely clear where you stand. So are you convinced that these phenomena are real, or do you approach these subjects with some measure of skepticism?
I approach everything with a measure of skepticism, and I fall into the same, you know, because of my training in engineering and science, I fall into the same, category as most people, that I need to see something in order to believe it. So, the fact that I haven't seen a UFO means that, you know, I'm skeptical that they exist. However, 150 million people claim to have seen them, and even if you discount 90% of those, you know, with the usual litany of trumped out reasons for what they've seen. They've seen a star. They've seen, you know, swamp gas or whatever. You're still left with a lot of unexplained things. There are fighter pilots who have seen things that are unexplained. There are astronauts who claim they've seen things unexplained. I mean, there are, you know, presidents and prime ministers of foreign countries who have claimed to have seen them. And you can't discount all of these reports and all these observations. All I'm saying in the book is that it's very possible to generate a UFO experience in a programmed reality. It could be the ultimate explanation for anything that you know falls into the category of an unexplained phenomenon. If you know much about software, it's not hard to generate something that defies laws of physics in a program. All gaming programs have a physics engine these days, and you know it's not hard to create something that the programmers put in there. It can be generated to appear and disappear and to look any way they want it to look and defy the laws of that physics engine that the characters are subject to.
God mode.
Exactly. In fact, you know, it wouldn't even be hard to put something in place that some people see and other people don't see. So, you know, the sky's the limit when you talk about a programmed reality, kind of scenario.
So in the book, you also talk about psychedelic drugs, LSD, and there's another one, DMT, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how that fits into this whole discussion, and by way of explaining that to us, give us the shocking truth about Santa's reindeer. That was that was the point where I had to put the book down for a few minutes. I have to.
Yeah, it's funny actually.
Blew me away.
A colleague of mine opened up the book one time and opened right to that page, and he goes, "What have you been smoking?"
I think it's what have you been eating, right?
But the interesting thing about this is that there have been some controlled experiments on hallucinogenic drugs, and there were experiments back in the 50s and the 60s, and then basically the government said, no, can't do that anymore, it's too dangerous. And Rick Strassman, is an individual who was able to get federal approval or FDA approval to conduct an experiment using DMT, which is a chemical that exists naturally in the brain. And, you know, in his research, he found that it existed in the brain at high levels at certain times. One time was during, inception. Another time was during death or near-death experiences. And it also tended to be high at 3 in the morning for some reason. And he used this to attribute a lot of, kind of paranormal phenomena that people experience as being perhaps due to high levels of DMT in their brain. But what he did was, conduct a controlled experiment with a number of people. I think it was in Arizona, University of Arizona, perhaps, and basically, wrote down all of their experiences. And most of them, I wouldn't say all, but most of them describe the feeling that the reality they jumped into under the influence of this drug was more real than the reality that they normally live and experience. And again, I'm not saying that that's certainly conclusive evidence. It's just interesting.
Very interesting that you would have that that perception, because you don't hear that normally about psychedelic drugs, that where they're taking you is some kind of fantasy land, right? They're taking you to cartoon world or something like that. But in this instance, and I think you mentioned that Sting had some tea down in Brazil or something like that, that he chose
right.
to spend 40 pages of his book talking about that. The idea that the curtain is lifted, and now under the influence of this drug, you're actually seeing past whatever the illusion of what this world is, and you're seeing the real world back there.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing was that the experience that people have had, and he was one. It's actually, I think, a little bit trendy now for people to go down to the jungles of the Amazon and hook up with a shaman and drink this tea called ayahuasca tea. But the interesting thing is that the same effects have occurred through shamanistic rituals via American Indians and Aboriginal groups around the world, either with or without assistance from various plants and things. So sometimes drumming has been reported to bring it out, or extreme dancing and other kinds of shamanistic rituals where people will experience what they claim is the true reality and be able to get in touch with other realms and things like that. And the thing that is interesting is that a lot of their experiences sound similar, and the similarity, there have been books written on this effect, and kind of curious about what it's all about. Some people speculate that that DMT or the shamanistic rituals may actually turn off the thing in your brain that prevents you from experiencing the true reality because it's too frightening, and instead allows you to experience the artificial one that's put in there. It's kind of like the guys in the Matrix had the artificial reality, but they took a drug to remove it. So, that is somebody's theory. I thought it was an interesting bit of evidence for the possibility that there is another reality behind everything, although not necessarily a programmed one. And another bit of evidence that we haven't touched on yet is just the whole fine-tuned nature of the universe. I mean, there are some...
Oh, wait, before we go there, because I did promise a listener we would touch on this, you've got
okay.
to tell us about Santa's reindeer.
That one, I'd probably have to dig back into the book to remember some about it, but I think there are some individuals who believe that a lot of the history of Santa Claus can be traced back to sort of pagan rituals with some of these hallucinogenic compounds. And I'll leave it for people to either read the book or look up things like there's a book called Breaking Open the Head, and I think if you just Google those words, Google mushrooms and Santa Claus, you'll probably find all kinds of...
Google mushrooms and... listeners, just Google mushrooms and Santa Claus.
Right, you'll find all kinds of things.
It will open your mind. It will blow your mind. Absolutely.
Right.
Okay, sorry. Let's talk about the universe being fine-tuned.
Sure. Now this one I also find to be pretty interesting. There are some universal constants that have to be at a certain level that cancel out all the vacuum energy in the universe to a part in 1 in 10 to the factor, 10 raised to the power of 115, which is just a ridiculously perfect tuning. The expansion rate of the early universe, they say, has to be accurate to 1 part in a billion, or it would have, if it was off by more than that in either direction, the whole universe would have either flown apart or it would have immediately collapsed. A tiny difference in the ratio of the electric field strength to gravitational field strength would have prevented molecules from forming, and so on and so on. There's, a dozen of these kinds of things that are in the million or billion, type of range for probabilities. And when you factor them all together, you don't add them up, you multiply them all out, and that gives you like an astronomical, probability or improbability that we would happen to have the physical constants and structure that we have today. So the traditional theory behind this is comprised of two things. One is something called the parallel universe theory, which is in a couple different forms. And one form is the quantum mechanical form, which says that every instant that somebody observes something, they actually the whole universe is a new universe is spawned. And in one universe, one decision was made. In the other universe, the other decision was made. And we're talking, billions, trillions. I mean, there's not even a number to describe it. Zillions of times a second, this could happen. So it's an astronomically huge number of universes that exist in parallel in this so-called Hilbert space. Then you couple that with something called the anthropic principle, which says that because there are so many universes that exist with so many different, characteristics of physics, so many different constants of physics, most of them are all benign, most of them can't support life, most of them probably can't even support matter, but of course the one that we can does because we wouldn't be here to observe it otherwise. So it's a combination of this wild idea of many, many, many parallel universes and the anthropic principle argument. And to my way of looking at it, that's a very complex solution to the problem. And, if you invoke Occam's razor, which says that the simplest solution tends to be the more accurate one, what sounds simpler? The idea that there are zillions of universes created every second, and that we just happen to be in the one that all the constants line up perfectly, or there's something behind it. There's a program behind it that has designed it this way.
Is that a rhetorical question, or should we pick one? Stephen, what do you think?
I'd be interested to hear what your thought is.
I'll go with Occam's razor on this one. I guess I'll go out on a limb on that, which I guess puts me squarely in. What's that?
More likely that it's a designed universe than many worlds and the anthropic principle, line with what Jim's saying. Okay.
That's how I feel too.
I had to punt. I was giving myself more time. I don't know. I'm so fond of many worlds. I hate to give it the short shrift in favor of another theory.
It's interesting that many worlds can also exist in the parallel universe theory. Just a very simple example, if you're familiar with World of Warcraft or EverQuest or any of these massively multiplayer online role-playing games, they run on different servers, and people can be in a world in one server and have a whole different set of individuals, monsters, whatever that they're interacting with. If they jumped into a different server, it'd be like a parallel universe. So the universe could be an instance of the program, a parallel one could be another instance of the program, and perhaps there's even ways to jump from one to another. Unix allows ways to jump between processes, and whatever is driving this thing could be at a technology level that's so far beyond what we think about. I mean, we think in terms of probably a 20-year horizon. We can kind of envision the direction that things are going 20 years, 30 years. When it gets to be 50 years, it's pretty fuzzy. But if you allow that there could be intelligences out in the universe that are hundreds of years, thousands, millions of years beyond ours, then their technology is something that we can't even imagine. It's like that Arthur Clarke quote, a sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right?
Right.
Exactly. So how about this? How about we're in a simulation, in a simulated universe, within a simulated universe, within a simulated universe, and I'll just keep repeating that a couple dozen times. Finally, you get up to the actual real universe, and it's part of a multiverse that has all the parallel universes. I mean, in fact, although Occam's razor, as you suggested, would cause us to pick between one or the other, there's no reason to say that one precludes the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, one of the things that people often bring up is, you know, okay, this idea does explain certain things or has the potential to explain certain anomalies, but at the same time, what's behind that? And that's not the purpose of the book. I'm not trying to, you know, determine where the real reality came from. I'm trying to make some sense out of the universe that we perceive. And so that's, you know, that's what the purpose is.
Let's talk Easter eggs for a second. You know, when games are designed, often the author will put in something to kind of wink at the audience or maybe in a way to sign his work or whatever. I mean, should we be looking for Easter eggs in the universe?
Sure. I don't know if you ever read Contact. Contact by Carl Sagan had this great concept at the end of the book where once pi was calculated out to a sufficient number of values, the numbers when either, I don't remember if they were converted to binary.
Lay it out on some kind of a grid, right?
Yeah, they formed a circle, and that was,
yeah.
You know, that would be indication, that would be an Easter egg. But one might say that, you know, highly improbable coincidences are Easter eggs. And one of the ones that I like to use is, it was in a book by Martin Plimmer and Brian King called Beyond Coincidence. There was a girl in the UK named Laura Buxton. She was 10 years old. She wrote her name on a balloon and released it from her garden 140 miles away. It lands in another garden of a girl named Laura Buxton, who was 10 years old.
And that is so bizarre.
Not only that.
When you read that, it turns out 9 out of 10 girls in the UK were named Laura Buxton.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I thought that the story by itself was interesting, and then somebody sent me, you know, the original article about it, and I found out that these two girls had, they each had a hamster, they each had a cat. I mean, there were like a million other coincidences. And, you know, I find the whole idea of coincidences very interesting. And if you get onto the skeptics' blogs, they will often say, well, coincidence is just the law of large numbers. You know, there are so many things that don't happen that could, that there's bound to be coincidences now and then. And, you know, I understand that, and I understand statistics and things like that. However, there are these certain things that happen every once in a while that just seem like they're beyond that, and it's a really hard thing to model mathematically. And I've actually searched for people who have tried to prove or disprove one way or the other whether these sort of astronomically, you know, unusual coincidences fall within the realm of statistics or not, and there really hasn't been any conclusive answer to that. They just feel like they're Easter eggs.
This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jim Elvidge about his book, The Universe Solved, talking about whether we live in a computer simulation or some other kind of simulated universe. We're going to be going a few extra minutes this evening, so there's still time to call. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 347-215-8972. And I think at this time we'll check in with Michael. Anything going on in the chat room, Michael? Questions for Jim?
We don't have any specific questions for Jim, and we're sort of off on our own, you know, closely related parallel tangent.
Okay.
Fair enough. Okay, we got the the mini worlds hypothesis being demonstrated here in the chat room this evening. Okay, well let us know if anything comes up.
Okay, well if I could just jump in real quick, one thing you brought up was the idea of the Easter eggs. If you were a programmer of a reality, you wouldn't want to necessarily give away a slam dunk Easter egg that made it, you know, completely obvious. If you were trying to maintain the illusion of the reality, you'd give just little hints, right?
That's true. I've heard the argument that one thing, you know, we should be careful of is that we don't completely give. If we are living in a simulation and we discover it, you know, for certain that we are, then that could be a simulation ender.
Right.
Yeah. So we need to be careful about that. I think that's pretty silly. But what's your thought on that, Jim?
You know, one of the things that I've thought a lot about is how do we know, and this is, you know, kind of indirectly answering your question, but how do we know when it started? You know, again, if you think about the technologies that we're experimenting now and that could be perfected in another reality, if you can upload memories, the way Kurzweil says we're going to be able to in 30 years, if you can upload memories and download memories, then, you know, theoretically it's possible to create a reality that just started 5 minutes ago. And, you know, all that stuff that you thought happened when you were a kid is just implanted in your head, and it happens to be synchronistic with all of the things that are implanted in other people's head who you interacted with when you were a child, and, you know, same with with the documents that are in libraries and other evidence of past history. So the question is, when did it start? Could it have started very recently, or could it have started a long time ago? I tend to think it's more the, you know, if there is something to this idea, I tend to think it's more the physical manifestation of reality, and it happened a long time ago, because I just have a little hard time with the whole reason behind it. You know, why would we, you know, want to be in a simulation? You know, what are the motives behind it? And that surprises me a little bit.
Jim, we have a caller. Let's bring our caller in.
Hello.
Hi, caller.
Welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Welcome to the program. Do you have a question for Jim Elvidge?
Yeah, I was wanting to talk about these Easter eggs for a minute. I thought that from what I understand, Jung and synchronicity, these Easter eggs are available for people that go searching for them. In other words, if you look for them, you'll begin to notice them more and more often, according to Jung, which a lot of psychologists, I know a psychology professor who won't even discuss Jung. They run from the topic. So what I'm thinking is that I've lost my train of thought.
Well, I think, if I could jump in, I think that's an excellent question, and I think that's one example of it. Jung is controversial because he's talking about things that are outside the, you know, sort of accepted norm of science. But the whole idea of sort of cosmic unconsciousness that he described, you know, is an example of something that could have an explanation in a programmed reality. So, for example, imagine that, you know, again, using a gaming analogy, imagine you're playing a game, and some people do this with World of Warcraft. They play a game where they interact with each other traditionally by typing. However, some of the guilds in that game allow you to, you know, put on a headset and have a communication channel which is completely different over the internet, so you can actually talk to the other people in your guild. So from the perspective of other people in the program, boy, it seems unusual that these two are in sync, you know, or that these people are working in sync. They seem to know what each other is doing. So there's back-channel mechanisms, you know, there's just an example of one that, you know, is possible. I can certainly imagine others where if our minds are connected to a, you know, quote, matrix of sorts, that we may be given hints of information, you know, without sort of hitting us over the head with a hammer, we may be given hints of information that allow us to experiencing these synchronistic types of things that Jung was talking about.
I remember him. I remember what I was going to say, and it ties into what you were just saying, that he warned against sort of trying to interpret these Easter eggs like a psychic would, that they had particular meaning. He thought that when you begin to experience the synchronicity more and more often, that it simply meant that you are where you're supposed to be. That was the interpretation that he advised people to take away from these synchronistic experiences instead of trying to read them like a particular sign. And that sort of ties in to if it only means you're where you're supposed to be, that sort of relates to the simulation scenario that you're painting, where perhaps you're in sync with the program.
Very good, very good. I agree.
Caller, could you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Harvey Barnes.
Oh, hi Harvey. Harvey has been a chat room participant for a while, haven't you?
That's right.
Okay, great.
Great to have you on the program, Harvey. It's great to hear your voice.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll try again later, and I'll try to be less nervous next time.
Oh, it's fine. You did great.
No, thanks.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Harvey. There are a couple other things his question reminded me of. I don't know if Steve and Phil, if you're familiar with the experiments that were done at Princeton, the Princeton Pair Project, regarding collective consciousness. They put these random number generators around the world. I think there are 70 or so of them. They referred to them as eggs, and they noticed that the random number generators tended to be more in sync during times where the worldwide population was focused on something. So a tsunami, an earthquake, 9/11, things like that. There were jumps in the synchronization of these random number generators. It's just something that's out there. Nobody has an explanation for it. And another example of this is, if you're familiar with any of Dean Radin's work, he wrote a book called The Conscious Universe, where he took all of the sort of paranormal experiments that have been done over the years, applied scientific rigor to them, and came to the conclusion that their results were well beyond statistical significance. So that there's like a subtle thing going on, you know, along the lines of the Easter egg. And it's a subtle thing, but it's definitely happening.
Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was about the references in the book to research into psychic phenomena, and definitely there are more and less, I guess, respected and credible kinds of research that go on in that field. I would guess across the board, parapsychology doesn't get an awful lot of respect from the hard sciences.
Right.
But when you talk about work that Dean Radin has done, or when you talk about the Princeton anomaly research, that at least has garnered some level of credibility and some respect. And you look at those and you say, well, it would appear that there's something there. When I look at the results from what they've done at Princeton, you think, well, there's something going on there anyway.
Right.
But at that point, I can't help but ask, well, can't we just conclude that therefore psychic phenomena are part, have some natural explanation, they are part of the universe? Why does that necessarily speak to a higher level of reality?
Oh, it doesn't. You're absolutely right. It could very well be something that we just haven't done enough research on to understand why. But I think it's a really interesting one, because we think that information propagates via electromagnetic waves, and we think that you can't exceed the speed of light because the only thing that propagates in a vacuum is electromagnetic waves, and it travels at the speed of light. So if there's another communication mechanism out there, you know, it would be very, very interesting to find out what its propagation speed is. And again, like you said, not necessarily evidence of a programmed reality, but, you know, just something that, you know, does imply that the reality we think we have is a little different than what's really there.
And if that phenomenon somehow works through something like quantum entanglement, it could be that its speed is instantaneous, but still within this universe. I mean, still just something that an odd quirk of how the universe happens to function.
Right. Certainly could be. One of the things I find interesting is just sort of watching the path of scientific research. It seems to follow the path that you might you know, expect something to follow, given that there's a programmed reality, and it's a little hard to explain. But you know, one example was, I think it was the neutrino that was discovered. It was predicted, then it was discovered short time after that, and then it was predicted that it might have mass to kind of explain another anomaly, and the evidence that it had mass was discovered in Soviet labs, but not in American labs, and the Soviets believed that that the neutrino probably had mass and it was a logical explanation for this, but the American labs didn't. Now, you might attribute that to, I forget what the effect is, you know, the effect of expectation effect of the experimenters. But it also feels an awful lot like there's, you know, there's something behind it sort of driving the evidence towards realization. You know what I mean?
like a patch has been uploaded.
Exactly.
That's fascinating.
Very interesting. All right, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jim Elvidge about his book, The Universe Solved. We're going to keep the lines open for just a few more minutes, and if you have a question for Jim, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972. Now, let's get into the possible explanations for who the programmers are. And in the book, you talk about basically that it's either going to be Earthlings, us, or it might be artificial intelligence, or it might be extraterrestrials, or it could be what you refer to as the gods.
Mm-hmm.
Basically these spiritual beings who truly live in a different plane of existence and would account for the kind of religious explanations for reality. What about the possibility that that we're intelligent beings and that we're living in a simulation and that we're part of that simulation, but that we don't have any particular seat of consciousness other than that, that's who we are and we live there. Do you think that's a possibility, or do you tend to think that if this is a simulation that our existence must have some other manifestation someplace else?
Yeah, I tend to think that there's another manifestation somewhere else. And again, you know, I'm not, I can't use the word believe or convinced or anything like that. I'm just looking at the evidence and what I see. This is something that just kind of makes sense to me. So, you know, I would tend to agree with that. And I differ a little bit from a lot of the transhumanists in that they tend to believe that an artificial intelligence will have the same kind of consciousness that we will have, that consciousness is an artifact of complexity of the computational mechanism of the brain. I tend to think there's something behind it. I feel that, you know, I don't care how complex a computer program is going to be, it's never going to be conscious the way I'm conscious. And I just, you know, I can't describe that in any better way than I did in the book, but it's just something that I believe and that I feel is evidence of, you know, it kind of narrows down some of the scenarios of how the programmed reality might play out.
But the basic kind of if not belief but bias then is that that human consciousness is something transcendent. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, I was just exploring that possibility that, you know, that let's say there is an other that we are connected to. It's your thought then that even if we had if we developed a computer that was just as complex as us, that whatever, you know, drives us, call it a soul or whatever, could not inhabit then the machine at all.
Right. I think that it's certainly possible that you can at some point upload, you know, effectively the state of your mind, maybe, you know, your memories, to save them off, to archive them off. I could imagine that. But I don't believe that you could transfer, you could willingly transfer your consciousness to another machine. I believe that it's possible your consciousness could decide to do that. And that might be the solution to the whole thing, that at some point when machines are sufficiently complex, our consciousness itself might say, hey, you know what, I'm going to make the jump between, wet organic humans to the silicon-based machine here, just to see what it's like to have consciousness within the machine. I could see that, but I don't think it's something that you can assume. Just the same way, I don't think you can assume that, you know how we're doing a teleportation now. We're doing teleportation of atoms at further and further distances and molecules, and ultimately we'll be teleporting matter. Well, what gets teleported is the data that describes the original matter. If it is possible someday to teleport humans, I don't believe that you can assume that your consciousness gets teleported as well.
Phil and I think we've both agreed in past shows that we're not going to be the first to step in the transporter.
Absolutely.
The question is, you know, when other people do it and they say to you, oh, I'm fine, will you believe them, and will you then step into the transport?
I might say to myself, well, yeah, you're fine, but the guy that stepped into the transporter at the other end is long gone.
Right, or exactly. Or would you allow the possibility that that person who stepped in the transport is a, you know, in gaming parlance, an NPC, a non-player character?
Soulless automaton or whatever.
Yeah, they could be saying whatever they're programmed to say.
Well, as long as we're willing to fall back to a purely solipsistic standpoint, anybody can get in the transporter but me.
Right.
You know, what happens to the rest of you guys? Okay, I don't know. I don't know that you're conscious now, for sure, right?
So, exactly. You can't know.
Yeah, so you know, if you want to go through the transporter, okay by me, but I'm not as sure that I'm ready to take the leap. But this kind of all goes to the whole problem of consciousness. We don't really know what we mean when we talk about consciousness, and it seems like the more I read about it, the less certain I become. Although I have to say, I hope that you're wrong on the idea that silicon can't evolve to become like us in experiencing consciousness the way we do. That either whatever's back there behind us might be behind them too, if that's actually required, or if it is just complexity that they can eventually reach that point and experience what we're experiencing. But
I'd say we make a wager, because I think we live in a day and age where we're likely to live to see either it come to pass, or it be shown that it's extremely unlikely to ever come to pass.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I don't know that it will, because we could have a highly conscious seeming computer out there. How would you know if it was conscious or not? I think is the real problem. It gets us into the whole Turing test, right?
Right, right. It's interesting. I have a little device that's a chatterbot made by AI.com on my website, and I've named him Morpheus, and people talk to him. And I've taken a poll and asked people what they think of the intelligence of Morpheus. And I've had a very surprisingly number of people, and I'm sure they're just being a little bit flippant, that say that they think he's smarter than most humans they know. But overall, the average IQ that the users have given me is 84. They think he's got an IQ of about 84. So it's, you know, we're coming along.
That's pretty good. 84, not bad at all. Certainly,
it is not bad.
That's a higher IQ than I'd give the typical IVR system that I have to deal with.
Oh, absolutely.
That's for sure. Yeah. So, well, we're getting pretty close to our time here. I think we're just about going to have to wrap it up. Stephen, any final questions?
No, we have covered a lot of ground, Jim, and I want to thank you for coming on the show. And it's a very provocative book, and I'd recommend it to anybody. The title is The Universe Solved.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being on the show. You guys have asked a lot of challenging questions, and it's been you know, very interesting. I'd leave you with one thought, if I may. A physicist from Stanford, Andre Lind, was once quoted as saying, "On the evidence, our universe was created not by a divine being, but by a physicist hacker."
Wow.
Well, there you go.
That's cool.
That would explain for all the cheesy Easter eggs like UFOs and Bigfoot. And
exactly.
Anything could. Well, continued success to you, Jim, and we hope maybe at some point in the future we'll have you back on the program.
Be glad to be back on. Thank you very much, Phil. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you,
thank
Michael.
Thanks, Jim.
All right.
Okay, well, that was fantastic. One of the funnest discussions I think we've ever had on this program.
Yeah, it was enjoyable.
Yeah. The music I guess we got for tonight, we're going to play some exit music. Phil, what do you think? Let's go with the Serenity music tonight.
Absolutely. What do you got?
Okay. It's a pretty geeky song. A guy by the name of Dan Sehan came out with this right before the movie Serenity came out. And obviously a big fan of Firefly. So we're going to give this a play.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to some music themed to Serenity. Once again, thanks to our guest, Jim Elvidge. Thank you, Stephen. We'll look forward to listening to the music and checking the show notes. Michael, thanks to you and for everyone hanging in on the chat room. Also, special thanks to our caller and to everyone who listened. We look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it. Good night.
Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or if you don't mind typing a few more characters, you can go straight to blog.speculist.com. That'll bring you straight to the good stuff. On The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about the future. We talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about what we believe is going to be a very bright future, one that will be here sooner than many of us expect, and one that we're all going to want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always, is my co-blogger and co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing great, Phil. How are you?
Well, I was mentioning before we started that I'm still dealing with the very last dregs of this this cold. I swear I've been talking about my cold as long as I talked about the Colorado Rockies last fall.
It's an ongoing feature.
About as many weeks.
Yeah, it's a
bad subject.
I want a post at the Speculist. It's a well fill, you know. It's pretty.
Yeah, simple. We want to get that up there soon. It's a well fill. Well, the doctor's got me on antibiotics, so I think I get rid of this cough. Spring is here in the Rockies, so I'm going to be on my bike here before too long, and all will be well, I'm sure. But how are things going with you?
All's well. All's well. And, yeah, got the kids back in from Boy Scout camp, the two older ones, this weekend. They had a great time, and, I mean, all manner of fun.
That sounds great. How long was Boy Scout camp?
Well, they spent the night two nights. Went Friday night and got back today. And I mean, it, you know, the whole spiel, everything you can imagine associated with Boy Scout camp, they did, you know, canoeing and archery and woodworking. And one neat project, they had one guy that was out there working on, I can't imagine what this looks like. I need a picture. And if I can get a picture, I'll put it up. But it's some guy was working on a wooden Ferris wheel with all the carvings. I mean, apparently the various Boy Scouts were contributing small carvings that were being placed on this wooden Ferris wheel. And so
how big of a? I mean,
I got the impression it was about a story and a half tall. So apparently, it's just
like big enough you could actually people could ride it.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh.
A big.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking like a model.
No, big deal. And Boy Scouts were contributing like little carvings and things that were like being put on for decoration around this Ferris wheel. And so yeah. It's, I thought that's a pretty interesting project. Yeah.
Well, that sounds pretty cool, but I got to tell you, it sounds a little Burning Man to me.
Just a little bit, doesn't it?
You want to keep an eye on that Boy Scout camp.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
In a strange
direction. We definitely want to make sure that it's on the up and up, don't we?
Well, yeah, you know, I just there's a you know, age appropriate, you know, for Burning Man, and then there's you know, your kid.
That's right, exactly.
So you got to watch out for that. We've also got Michael Darling with us this evening. Michael, how are you?
Good evening. You're reminding me that Burning Man, good idea.
Yeah, for adults.
But I'm thinking there might be a way to take a bunch of Cub Scouts to Burning Man. Cub Scouts at Burning Man. I think it could be a thing.
Well, maybe it could, because Burning Man is all about being a community, and I believe that some of the participants do bring their children to Burning Man.
I think I would have to. I saw it on
carefully monitored,
so it must happen.
Yeah.
However, I bet a very, very small subset of them are also participants and scouts. Just call it a hunch. It just, I could be wrong, but I think the overlap between the Burning Man crowd and the Boy Scout camp is not that great.
all the more reason I say that's why the scouts should be there.
Well, there you go. Okay.
I mean, holy cow!
Building community.
Yeah.
Diversity or whatever you want to, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Michael, we understand that belated birthday greetings are owed to you, so happy belated. How was the birthday?
It was exactly as I wished it. It was very low-key and almost like no one knew. That was good. It was, I didn't do anything big, didn't, you know, do anything stupid or reckless. As far as I know.
Well, you see, I like going the other way. I like big, stupid, and reckless.
For your birthday, yeah, you know, I mean, when else?
Yeah, once a year, you know, whatever.
I've done that.
I think we definitely want to keep Stephen away from Burning Man. I don't know. Or I don't know, maybe send him as our special correspondent.
Yeah.
He could have his birthday at Burning Man.
But when does Burning Man fall every year?
When?
In the summer. It's like late August into September.
Okay. Well, that's not
Harvey
my birthday.
Tell us exactly. I think he was in the chat room just saying something about Burning, or perhaps I'm wrong, but I thought he was. I don't know. I can't talk and read chat at the same time. Isn't that your job, Michael, actually?
Exactly. That's my, Michael, that's your department, man.
Yeah, okay.
Keep us informed on what's going on.
Talk and read chat at the same time. That's all we ask of you. And if you can chew gum, fine, but, you know, just those two things. That's the main thing we're looking for. Well, anyway, happy belated. We won't go into details about how old or anything. I think it's suffice to say that you're the oldest guy on the program this evening.
There you go.
Okay.
And I'm you know, not even a third of the way to my 150-year-old life expectancy, so.
Well, there it is, so. That kind of, yeah, that puts you in a ballpark without having to get too specific.
That's right.
So we got a great show this evening. We've got a number of really cool topics that we're going to be talking about, mostly around the future of ethics, and we're going to get a little bit into how our ideas of right and wrong might be evolving over the centuries. But I want to start out by observing what yesterday was. Speaking of auspicious days, Michael's birthday this week, and also yesterday was, I called it on the blog, Jury's Night. Actually, I got that from this group, jurysnight.net, where they encourage people to have big parties celebrating the first manned space flight, which was 47 years ago yesterday, the first flight of Yuri Gagarin into orbit The Russians beat us in the space race, and that was 47 years ago yesterday. And 27 years ago yesterday was the first ever space shuttle flight. So they actually timed the first flight of the space shuttle to coincide with the anniversary of Gagarin's first flight.
That's interesting. I wonder if they were trying to step on his date. You know, I mean, we were still in the middle of it. We were still, I guess you could still say that's the late space race.
We had won the space race by then. But
yeah,
it was definitely still Cold War.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. You know, Gagarin was dead by then. I think it was probably more of a tribute than a...
But did not Gagarin have a bunch of flights? I mean, that guy was in space, like, you know, every other weekend, wasn't he?
Well, I actually don't know what his total record in space was. I know that... he ended up married to Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space. And apparently that was more of, from the way the story is told, more of a marriage of propaganda convenience, that the communists really wanted the first man in space, the first woman in space married, and they became this major kind of public relations arm of the Soviet Union for some time. They ended up divorced. And he actually died doing flight tests. He died in an airplane crash while still relatively young. So I don't know how many more space flights he did. But
I was going to suggest that given the planned future of the shuttle, perhaps they could time the last flight of the shuttle to coincide with the date of his last trip to space, because I don't think it's that far off.
Yeah, that's true. The shuttle is winding down its career, and how interesting that. That the first shuttle flight came only 20 years after Gagarin's first flight, and here we are some 27 years later, shuttle still in service. And, well, I don't know how other people feel about it. To me, the shuttle always felt like kind of a step back, like it wasn't the big leap forward that some of the earlier progress in space flight had represented. It almost feels like we're kind of in a bit of a lull in terms of our development of manned space flight ever since we've been... flying the shuttle. What do you guys think?
Instinctively and emotionally it feels that way because the shuttle doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it goes into orbit, and that's in and of itself cool, but it just goes and it comes back, and it goes and comes back. I'm like, oh, but it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Although, who was it? Robert A. Heinlein who said, or somebody who said, low Earth orbit is halfway to anywhere. So, you
well,
know,
that's
breaking the gravity well, I mean, that's the big deal, isn't it?
That is the big deal. But which is better, to get halfway to anywhere or all the way to,
somewhere,
the moon? And that, to me, is part of the significance. I was writing about this in the blog post about Gagarin's achievement. To me, a huge part of the significance of that was how it was responded to in this country, that we looked at the launch of Sputnik and then especially Gagarin's flight into space as a major threat to potentially to our national security, that the Russians were going to take the high ground, they were going to have weapons up there, they were going to own the new frontier, and we were going to be left on the dustbin of history because of their leapfrogging over us technologically, and that had to be responded to. And in fact, it was in May of 1961, and this would have been not even a month and a half after Gagarin's flight, President Kennedy makes a speech before a joint session of Congress, and he says this. He says, "First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him back safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish." So within a few weeks, really, of Gagarin, we decided we had to go to the moon.
Right.
And
it's not a coincidence, is it?
That is no coincidence. This was definitely in response to that. Now, what I just read was President Kennedy's first mentioning of that, but I don't think that's the most famous articulation of that, which we do have recorded. Stephen, if you could cue that up.
All right.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
That was later in 61?
That was actually in September of 1962. He was speaking at Rice University.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about audacious. I mean, we choose to go to the moon, and we're going to go because we choose to. I mean, that's
right.
It's,
and not because it's easy, but because it's hard.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you love to hear the President of the United States, whoever it ends up being here, say something like that?
Yeah.
It would just be incredibly inspiring.
Well, you know, some presidents could pull off. I'm sorry, go ahead, Michael.
What would be the equivalent for our time? What would be the spring of 2009 audacity or audacious claim to go, hey, we're going to bring a man to the, would it be just further out? We're going to put a man on Mars and bring him back safely, or would it be some other advance?
Well, we couldn't put a man on Mars. We'd have to put a team on Mars.
Right.
Mars is a whole different level.
Yeah, or we choose to go to Mars and establish a presence there, maybe.
Yeah.
Or possibly we choose to develop a new source of energy. Michael, I think you've talked about that one before, being kind of an Apollo-level
I would love to see that be the bar. We're going to have a working fusion reactor producing commercially viable electricity by the end of, by 2020. Not because we know it's easy, but exactly because we know it's hard. It'll be the great technological challenge, but we can do it.
You know, I was just thinking when I was listening to Kennedy, you know, there's some presidents that can pull that off, and then some presidents that can't. And I don't want to get political. We try to be apolitical. But you can imagine, Kennedy saying something like that. Maybe on the other side, you could perhaps imagine Reagan having said something.
I think Ronald Reagan could have pulled something like that
off. Could have pulled something like that off. Carter would not say we choose to go to the moon. I'm sorry. I don't know. It's just there are some presidents that just couldn't pull it off. Kennedy could do it.
I don't think our current president could have pulled
it off. Yeah. I don't. And you know, at some point he's kind of flirted with the idea of pushing Mars, as did his father. But he just couldn't. He's not going to make some speech that motivates the nation to put the billions that it would require in probably. What do you think? Maybe trillions that would require to put a team on Mars?
It was estimated at $1 trillion like 20 years ago. So,
yeah.
But of course, that was using different technology than we have now. So it's really hard to say how much it would cost to put a settlement on Mars, but it's a lot of money for sure.
Yeah, a big old pile of cash. Yep, no doubt.
Although I would say that it's not just the... it's not just the oratorical skills of the leader that make that possible. You've got to have a very broad, optimistic view of the future to say something like that.
Right.
All that about, we're going to do it because it's difficult. This will let us show the best of our skills and the best of our energies. Just that model of inspiring people to do something grand requires a particular outlook.
I think you also have to have the moment.
Yeah.
Kennedy had Gagarin's launch. He had Sputnik. He had people thinking space was the next thing. You had those in the know acknowledging flat out that we're nowhere. At the end of World War II, the Russians got to East Berlin first, and they took all the heavy rocket guys, and we got there late, and we got the precision guys. But, the precision guys is nice, but we can't launch anything. So you had the moment, and here comes 61. Now, okay, the guy had to seize it. He had to have delivery. He had to have that Boston accent. I don't know. That works on me.
The decade.
Decade.
Who else pronounces it decade? But he put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
I'm just saying, in addition to everything else, he also had the context of the moment.
Yeah,
and if he'd been claiming, "Hey, we're going to cure cancer by the end of the decade," I don't. There's no context for that in 1961. I don't think it would have worked.
No.
I think
wouldn't.
You're right.
Absolutely,
that is a huge piece of what he accomplished there. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're opening up the phone lines now. We're talking about the space program. We'll be talking a little bit about the future of ethics. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 347-215-8972. Now, I was looking around for information on Gagarin, and I went online to one of my favorite sites, a site where you would expect to find info on Gagarin. Can anyone think of what that might be? Where would you go if you want to find good information on Yuri Gagarin?
I would start with Wikipedia.
Or YuriGagarin.net.
Well, both good ideas. But I went to Pravda, of course.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Because, you know, if anybody's going to be making a big deal out of the anniversary of Gagarin's flight, you think, well, it's got to be Pravda, right? Plus, Pravda, if you haven't been there in a while, is a trip. You definitely need to spend some time on the Pravda website. Well, they did have a big story about Gagarin, but I noticed they also had a big big editorial about how Tibet has always been part of China, and that the people saying that the Tibetans should be free are just imperialist capitalists trying to exploit the worker. I don't know. I didn't get very far with it, but I was thinking, well, you know, some things don't change all that much. I guess Pravda kind of holds to its line pretty well. But then I found another piece, and that piece takes us into the world of the mysterious, the world of the strange, into a little feature that we like to call
Tales of the Paranormal.
So on this edition of Tales of the Paranormal, I'm going to share with you guys what I accidentally found on Pravda while looking for information on Yuri Gagarin. And let me just first share the headline with you. I hope you guys are sitting down. Okay, I hope all our listeners are sitting down. Mutants live in the underworld of Moscow.
Well, how's this paranormal, though? You know, there might really be mutants living in the underworld of Moscow.
Oh, are we talking like Chud, or are we talking something else?
Okay, A, you got to stick with me on these. But
okay.
B, I throw a lot of stuff into paranormal. I think anything that would have made a good X-Files episode, I'm going to call paranormal.
Okay.
Yeah, well, what kind of mutants are we talking about? I mean, is this
Well, thank
Chud?
You for asking, Michael. What an excellent question. The story starts out, this could be a plot for a Hollywood movie. Giant half-inch worms live under the ground of a huge megapolis, but I believe they mean megalopolis, threatening the life of millions of its citizens. For the citizens of Moscow, Europe's biggest city, this is, however, a reality. Such worms were found and caught on video camera by Vadim Mikhailov, a founder of the Diggers organization in Russia.
Half-inch worms?
Well, that's what it says. Half-inch doesn't really sound all that giant.
Yeah, that's disappointing. If it's going to threaten Moscow, it needs to be a 30-foot worm.
This could be a bad translation, and maybe they mean half a foot.
Yeah, I hope so.
It could be a bacteria-sized worm and be a threat, but the question is, what makes them mutants?
And what makes them a threat?
Well, hang on, okay?
All right.
The accident happened not far from the city center. It was witnessed by many diggers that were accompanying Mikhailov. We recorded the video of a giant roaring worm on the video camera, or nobody would believe us. However, why are you laughing? What? Was there a joke? Did someone make a joke? Hello.
I was slow to hit the mute button. Sorry.
However, today we still have to prove on special machines that our record hasn't been edited. So, okay, I want you guys to understand that special machines are being used to verify this video.
It's going to be a track tape player.
Other weird things living down under Moscow. Apparently they've got grasshoppers the size of saucers. They've got giant American cockroaches. Don't know how they're American, how they know they're American, but they're giant American cockroaches. But anyway, that's all well and good. But
well, they're capitalists, probably.
Let me get to the
cockroaches. Okay, all right. Go
yeah,
on.
Well, perhaps it's the behavior that gives them away as Americans. That's a good call, Stephen. The most experienced digger in Russia, Vadim Mikhailov, thinks the underworld is the beginning of an outer world. He believes in the existence of parallel worlds. People explore the space, he claims, or space. I believe that's an unneeded article there. People explore space, he claims, but the underworld is much more interesting and charming. We walk daily above the world that is far more unusual and fascinating than our own world. He became convinced in this after he saw a woman's ghost with his own eyes. He claims the woman was scared and said something like, "Help me." He was caught by surprise and suddenly fell down on the ground. Then his friends took him to the hospital, where he also saw another ghost, and she looked the same and was wearing a long dress. So anyway, the story goes on, but I think the important thing to note here is that there are giant, roaring, half-inch worms under Moscow, and that it is the underground portion of Moscow is the key to the underworld.
Okay, yeah, that's paranormal. That's definitely paranormal.
Yeah, I told you it would get more paranormal as we...
It's not Chud, and it's not Soviet Chupacabra, but it's pretty dang good. And Scooby-Doo has to go investigate.
No doubt.
Yeah, I think, well, that's right. They'll pull the rubber mask off the ghost, and it'll be like Vladimir Putin or something.
The howling worm will be a holograph. It's easy. I see how they did it.
No, I think there may be more to this than that. I think this could indeed be the gateway to another world. But we'll have to leave that for now and explore this again on the next edition of
Tales of the Paranormal.
Very nice work, Stephen. You have really got the switch down.
Hey, I'm on the button over here.
You are totally on the button. So let's actually talk about our topic for the evening, which is the future of ethics. And I thought we would start off looking at the relationship between human beings and animals. And I had written a post on this today. The title of the blog post was Bring on the Meat Factories. And the basic subject here is I rehashed a good deal of material about how I came to where I currently am with my own carnivorous habits. And where I am with them is I no longer eat mammals, which is always a kind of a conversation stopper whenever you're like out with coworkers or even family and you're trying to explain it. You know, somebody will say, "Oh, so you won't have a steak, but you'll have chicken." It's like, right? Well, I don't eat red meat. You know, you can say red meat, and that pretty much gives the idea. But basically, what I have done is I've drawn kind of a developmental line, and I've said I'm not going to participate in killing animals above a certain level of sophistication for my food. So I continue to eat chicken and turkey. I eat poultry and I eat fish, but I don't eat mammals. And I point this out in the blog post. This really doesn't come up all that much, but if offered marsupial, I would not eat that either.
So basically, it's living things with lips that you won't eat.
If it has hair.
That is a great, you know, hair's pretty good, but come on, lips. You've heard that old, well, nothing with a face, right? I'm like, well, I don't know. A fish has a face. I'll eat it. A chicken's pretty much got a face. I'll eat those. But I think you might be right.
Yeah, lips kind of.
Fish got lips, man. Fish got lips.
I don't know if I'd call those lips, but okay. So you're saying that the lip definition doesn't work for you? Whatever.
I
say
it,
we're at the top of the
I really
food chain.
Like that.
Eat away.
I saw Mr. Limpet. They have lips.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever been fit, what's the hook going in there? That's a fish lip, man. Unless you hooked it wrong. But I did like that. I did like that definition. But you know, all levity aside, this is an attempt on my part to reflect a serious ethical stance.
Yeah.
And as I said in the blog post, I started on my birthday, August 31st, 2007. And I had my final red meat meal, my final mammal, and I said, "That's it. I'm done with this now." And I'm not sure if I'm done with it for the rest of my life or if I'm just taking a year off. I'm about 6 months in, so I have some time to think about that. But the idea being that I believe that we're heading towards a future in which it will no longer be considered ethically correct to kill animals, to enslave and kill animals for our food.
I agree, but not for the usual reasons that most vegetarians would put on it. And I think you were kind of going in that direction, Phil. But so sorry to interrupt.
Well, tell me, but go ahead, Stephen. Distinguish what you would say is your view from what you would take to be the standard vegetarian line.
Well, the direction you're going, I know what you're about to mention, Phil, was that in the very near future, it's going to be possible to manufacture meat without the animal.
Right.
Bat meat, or whatever you want to call it, is going to be available, and it'll be disgusting at first and get better and better, and pretty soon it'll be as good as you know, the steak off the hoof, you know. And also there'll be, I think that there'll be types of meat that nature never even thought about, you know. There'll be meat-type products that, you know, that we've never gotten to eat before because there's no such animal.
That was a scene I wanted to see in Jurassic Park. I wanted to see those guys eat one of those creatures.
Yeah, have a.
It's like, you know, hey.
T-Rex steak would be pretty awesome.
You got it.
Just to say,
it ain't going to taste like chicken.
Well, it's not going to taste like chicken. It's not going to taste very good either, because typically speaking, carnivores don't make good meat, right?
Yeah, you could. A brontosaurus steak would be better.
Would probably be better.
Yeah.
See, the Flintstones had it right with their Bronto burgers.
That's right.
That's right. Flintstones got it right. Yeah, no doubt.
But in fact, you're right, Stephen. Part of the idea here is, if I make this choice and others like me make this choice, this helps to create some market pressure for those of us who look forward to the day that I look forward to the day I can have a steak again, and that steak will not have come from an animal that was killed. It will just be something that was produced via a manufacturing process. And
once we have that, and let's say it's, you know, comparably priced to, you know, the steak from the feedlot that's right, you know, is sitting right next to it in the same freezer section, the same grocery store, and it costs the same, and it's just as good, then all of a sudden people will grow a conscience on that. I really believe that that's the point at which people say, well, to heck with this. I can not eat it and not kill an animal, get the same wonderful tasting steak, and I can feel good about myself too.
I think that's I think that is exactly where that will happen. And what's interesting is one of the drivers behind this is not the whole ethical dimension. I got interested in this because I see this as kind of a sort of a next step in our ethical evolution. But the group that has just had its first ever conference on this, the In Vitro Meat Consortium. And I got to say, if vat meat doesn't sound appetizing, boy, how does in vitro meat sound? They need marketing people soon. Okay?
Yeah,
but it's not veal. I mean, it's not like you're eating it in vitro. You're growing it in vitro.
Yeah.
Still, it doesn't sound like something I want to, you know, in vitro.
In vitro meat. It just sounds pretty gross. I had the first get together, and one of the things they're talking about the costs and those kinds of things, but the real push is environmental.
Yeah, yeah.
Because cattle create a lot of methane, and methane is actually a much more dangerous greenhouse gas than CO2.
Yeah, about 10 times the potency of the CO2
exactly.
As far as heating the planet. Yep.
So cattle production has this huge carbon footprint, and it has other damage that it causes to the environment. That presumably, although I don't know too much about the process, this manufacturing process for meat would not have. So they're actually pursuing it from an environmental standpoint, and the ethical piece kind of comes along for a ride.
Well, and so it gives you another thing to feel good about when you're shopping in the grocery store and you see, you know, this flaming. And you know, here's an interesting point, and I think that this will come out. I think that they won't be able to call it filet mignon, or you know, I bet you the ranchers will have the political pull to say, you know, no, it's not filet mignon. It doesn't come from an actual cow. Therefore, you have to call it something else. So they'll have to come up with their own labels.
It'll be a pasteurized, processed, simulated meat food product,
which doesn't sound nearly as good as filet mignon.
Getting hungry, yeah.
It'll be something like the generic, you know, compared to filet mignon, you know.
that's what marketing will kick in, and they'll come up with a good name for it.
Oh yeah.
And you're right though. I wonder if they will in fact encounter that. It's like it's
champagne versus sparkling
wine.
You
make a sparkling wine in Idaho, you don't get to call it champagne because it does not come from, or Burgundy because it doesn't come from that region in France.
Yeah.
And you don't get to use that name. I think you're probably right. If it wasn't actually chopped off a pig, you don't get to call it a pork chop. I think there might be a legal case against
pork-esque chop, or I don't. They'll come up with something.
It makes lots of money. They're bringing Firefly back to me with Mal and Book and Yay Kaylee. I'm gonna see Serenity. I'm gonna cheer when Mal fades. to misbehave. His pants are tight, his manner wry. At Inara, he makes calf eyes. I'm gonna cheer when Mal says. And River, oh, I love River. I wish River were my sister. I'd fix her brain and keep her safe. Like Simon says, she's my may-may. And River, oh, I love River. I'm gonna see Serenity 3 times so that it makes lots of money. They took our land, they took our love. Well, now they'll take our ticket stubs. I'm gonna see Serenity.
Big damn heroes made a film.